The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For this, what is supposed to be the fifth installment of the August 2018 issue of Oprah Magazine, because we've read all the content in the first four installments, I'll be reading a selection of health articles from the last year of Oprah Magazine. These articles are found in the Feeling Good sections of magazines from September 2017 through May of 2018. From September 2017, our first article is called Listen Up, Doc, How to Get Your Medical Provider's Attention So You Can Receive the Best Possible Care. A meaningful chat with your physician could save your life, or at least help lengthen it. Even in this age of advanced scanning technology, your ability to clearly describe your health problems and help your doctor understand them is critical to getting an accurate diagnosis, says Danielle Offrey, MD, PhD, an associate professor of medicine at NYU School of Medicine, and author of What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. Offrey says, quote, good communication with your doctor is the single most important medical tool you have to get and stay healthy, end of quote. In fact, research shows provider-patient conversation is so powerful, it can even numb pain. In one 2014 study, patients receiving a sham treatment for chronic back pain reported a nearly 55% decrease in their discomfort when their physical therapist listened actively, showed empathy and warmth, and offered encouragement. But too often, doctors take a more hurried approach in the name of efficiency. Offrey cites a study that found that doctors typically interrupted their patients 12 seconds after they started talking. Yet, according to other research, the average person takes a mere 92 seconds to sum up why they're in the office. Offrey says, quote, doctors need to stop talking, turn away from the computer, and give patients 1 to 2 minutes of full frontal listening. If yours isn't doing that, don't be afraid to speak up, end of quote. How to assert yourself when you are sitting on a table in a paper gown? We asked Offrey, who's also an attending physician at Bellevue Hospital in New York City, for her best RX. And we have several questions here that the O staff posed to Dr. Offrey. And here's the first one. What's the most tactful way to let my doctor know I still had more to say when he interrupted me? Dr. Offrey. A gentle reminder can actually be very helpful for us. If a patient says, do you mind if I just finish what I was saying? I usually respond with something like, sure. Oh, wow. I shouldn't have cut you off. Here's the next question. How much information should I give the doctor? Dr. Offrey's reply. Before your visit, choose two or three concerns you want to discuss. If you have more, write them all down and show them to your doctor at the beginning of the appointment so you can decide together what's most important to discuss today and what may need to wait until next time. Try to cover the bases without getting bogged down in unnecessary details, which can waste time. The next question. Are there other ways to improve understanding between my doctor and me? And the answer, it's effective to say, I just want to reiterate my top three things, X, Y, and Z. Is there any other information that would be helpful for you? At the end of the appointment, say, okay, let me make sure I've got all this right. Then repeat back the doctor's advice or treatment plan. This not only ensures accuracy, but also helps jog your memory and your doctor's about points you or he forgot to mention. For example, it may prompt him to tell you about a potential side effect of the medication he's prescribed. Our next to the last question. How do I make extra sure I don't miss anything? The answer. Always have a pen and paper. You can also consider bringing a family member or a friend to your appointment to help fill in the gaps. I recently saw an older patient who'd just been diagnosed with breast cancer, and she was having trouble keeping things straight. On the next visit, she brought her adult daughter with her. We all talked together, and the daughter took notes. And the final question, should I ask what my doctor would do if he were in my shoes? Dr. Offrey's answer. This question comes up a lot. I try to help patients work through their own values using the medical facts I can offer. I once had a patient whose cardiologist had recommended an implantable defibrillator. The patient's general philosophy was to leave everything to God. So when he asked me, "What would you do?" I thought about his past decisions. He was taking blood pressure pills and had done a cardiac catheterization. Clearly, in this case, he seemed okay altering the course set out by God. He also had a lot to live for, including a wife, children, and grandchildren. We discussed the medical evidence and his religious beliefs, and ultimately, I recommend that he get the defibrillator. It's so important that your doctor take your values, not his, into consideration, along with the risks and benefits of treatment. So a better way to phrase this might be, given my situation, what do you think I should do? And now, here on a sidebar, under the heading Missed Connections, here's a quote from What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. In a survey of nearly 240 hospitalized patients, only 32% can name even one of their treating doctors. And to finish off this article, we have a little chart that has three columns. The patient says, the doctor hears, and then the doctor thinks. And this is under the heading Patient-Doctor Communication Decoded. Danielle Offrey, MD, PhD, reveals how she and other physicians interpret what patients tell them and how they use that information. So in the first of four rows, the patient says, I have the worst stomach pain, the worst dizziness, the worst headache 24/7. The doctor hears, I'm under a lot of stress. And here's what the doctor thinks. When a patient tells us that every symptom is the most horrible ever and the physical exam and labs are normal, we often suspect something psychological is going on. The symptoms aren't fake. They're physical manifestations of anxiety, depression, and stress. So while I'm always on the lookout for a serious underlying disease, I'm also thinking, can I get her to see a therapist or enroll in a yoga class or eat a healthier diet or get better sleep? Now, our second row, the patient says, everything's fine. The doctor hears, there may be something I'm not telling you. And this is what the doctor thinks. I worry that the patient may be uncomfortable about sharing something. It could be sexual dysfunction, an eating disorder, depression, domestic violence. These are serious topics many people don't want to talk about. I'll try to follow up with questions like, how are things at home? How's work? But we don't always have time to probe. Don't be afraid to bring up the important things going on in your life, even if they don't feel medical. Your doctor would rather know than not know. On our third of four rows, the patient says, oh, just one drink per night. The doctor hears, at least two drinks per night. And the doctor thinks, we're taught in medical school that people usually underreport their alcohol and drug use, so we generally double the amount we're told. Don't be insulted if your doctor asks follow-up questions about your drinking. We're trying to be diligent so we don't miss an alcohol or drug disorder that could be amenable to treatment. And our final row, the patient says, here are my records from my previous doctor. The doctor hears, I'm about to dump a pile of info on you. The doctor thinks, patients sometimes bring in years worth of medical records and reviewing them would take valuable time from the visit. It's best to prioritize what you want the doctor to see, like a recent heart test from a cardiologist, and put those documents on top. And here's one more article from the September 2017 issue of Oprah. And this one's called Flex Time, Still and Feeling Good. Doctors are no longer waiting decades to give patients new hips and knees. But before you trade yours in, there are a few things you should know. If you're young, fit, and healthy, your body is supposed to move when you tell it to, right? That's what Robin Benicasa, a 40-year-old San Diego firefighter, triathlete, and all-around badass, always thought. Benicasa says, quote, "Then one day in the middle of a week-long race of biking, kayaking, and mountaineering, my leg refused to take a single step," end of quote. She'd had some pain in the front of her hips for 2 years, but assumed she'd pulled something that would eventually heal. She was wrong. A few weeks after her leg seized up, an orthopedic surgeon diagnosed Benicasa with advanced osteoarthritis in both hips. Translation, the cartilage that cushioned her joints had worn away, causing inflammation, pain, and stiffness that had finally stopped her short. After a few surgeries, Benicasa would eventually end up with two new hip joints. Benicasa may have been 20 to 30 years younger than the typical hip replacement patient, but women like her, who get a new joint before a pair of bifocals, are becoming surprisingly common. From 2000 to 2010, the number of total hip replacements in people ages 45 to 54 shot up 205%, and the rate of total knee replacements in people ages 45 to 64 nearly tripled. The joint replacement boom is due in part to groundbreaking advancements in surgical materials and techniques. Benjamin Bings, MD, Chief of Joint Replacement Surgery at UCLA Health, says, quote, "Arthritis has been around since humans started walking upright. We've always had people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s who needed joint replacements because of it. We just wouldn't do the surgery on patients so young because the implants wore out too fast," end of quote. In the past, hip and knee implants were made primarily of metal or a combination of metal and polyethylene plastic. Over the course of 10 or 15 years, fewer in the case of younger or very sporty patients, the hard metal would wear away the new joint, causing the mechanism to not only loosen but also release potentially harmful particles into the body. Newer artificial joints have at least one component made from specially treated wear-resistant ceramic or plastic that can, in theory, take a licking and keep on ticking and turning for decades. Bings says, quote, "It seems so simple, but the durability of the new surface was revolutionary," end of quote. While there have been no long-term studies of people who got these new joints, they haven't been around long enough, researchers have done lab simulations to estimate longevity. Their findings? After 30 years' worth of use, one artificial knee joint showed only about 20% of the wear that an old-school version showed after the equivalent of just 3 years. Another improvement is the new surgery technique. Take knee replacements. Stephen Haas, MD, Chief of Knee Service at Hospital for Special Surgery in New York, says, quote, 35 years ago, we would put you under general anesthesia, remove the entire knee, and replace it with a whole new hinge. Now we use a combination of regional and local anesthetic, shave off small amounts of bone, and resurface them with wear-resistant metal, ceramic, and plastic. The plastic caps are designed to fit precisely over the underlying bone and are secured with bone cement. It's like a dentist putting a cap on a tooth. End of quote. These efficient and refined surgical techniques mean shorter recovery times. Haas says his patients are usually out of the hospital in 2 days. Within a few weeks, they're walking cane-free, and after about 3 months of rehab, which younger patients are often able to tackle more aggressively, most are feeling almost like their old selves. This is good news for the growing population of those who find themselves hobbling around in pain before their time. Haas says, quote, "People are more athletic at younger ages now, which means more sports-related injuries. This puts you at higher risk for osteoarthritis and needing a replacement down the road," end of quote. On the other end of the spectrum, more young people are obese than in the past, and extra weight can do a number on joints. Haas says, quote, "When you go up or down stairs, you can put pressure up to 3 to 5 times your body weight on your knees. The heavier you are, the more quickly the joints can wear out, end of quote. Because surgeons used to wait until patients were at least 60 to do the surgery, some people were left trying to ignore their discomfort for years. Now doctors can be much more responsive, but there are still good reasons to hold off on new joints, at least until you've tried other remedies. Daniel O'Neill, MD, an orthopedic surgeon in Plymouth, New Hampshire, and author of Knee Surgery, The Essential Guide to Total Knee Recovery, says, quote, "We don't yet have data saying these new implants will definitely last 30 or more years when you put them in an active 45-year-old. And if the first implant does need to be replaced, that second surgery can be exponentially harder on your body," end of quote. Younger patients' enthusiasm to get back in action at home, work, the gym, can also affect their recovery, says O'Neill, who has replaced knees in alpine skiers as well as retirees. O'Neill says, quote, "It's easy to get discouraged that it's been 6 weeks and you aren't as far along as you want to be," end of quote, especially if you're juggling children, an intense job, and the other responsibilities of people in their 40s and 50s. This leads some younger patients to do too much too fast or creates unrealistic expectations. Marathons, O'Neill says dryly, aren't the best idea for people with new knees. Replacement surgeries should be thought of as a last resort, agrees Joshua Jacobs, MD, chair for the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. He says, quote, "Osteoarthritis tends to creep up on you over time, and there are strategies that can slow the progression before it gets so bad that you can't move without pain. Before you even talk about scheduling surgery, you should try anti-inflammatory drugs, corticosteroid injections, and physical therapy," end of quote. In addition, even a small amount of weight loss can lessen force on the joints, points out Mary Beth Horodisky, former vice president of the National Athletic Trainers Association and professor of orthopedics and rehabilitation at the University of Florida. In some cases, this alone can ease the pain enough to make a replacement unnecessary. As for Benicasa, she's never looked back. Less than a week after her first surgery 10 years ago, she was on a stationary bike, and a week and a half later, she was walking with a cane and swimming. She says, quote, "Each time my hips could handle a new activity, like hiking in the Grand Canyon, I was so excited. I've even been able to feed my competitive spirit by doing ultra-distance kayak races, which don't strain my hips as much as running, and winning. Looking at me, you'd have no idea I have 2 bionic hips." In November's Feeling Good section, we have a quiz. What's your headache IQ? Solid Intel gives you a better chance of beating the pain. Test your smarts with our quiz. And there are 4 questions here. The first one, how would you diagnose these symptoms? Facial pain, pressure over the sinuses and forehead, nasal congestion, nausea. We have 4 answers. A, tension headache. B, sinus headache. C, migraine. D, caffeine withdrawal. Answer C, migraine. There are 24 types of headaches according to the National Headache Foundation, and telling them apart is tricky. For example, sinus headaches and migraines have overlapping symptoms. But the addition of nausea and the absence of fever and heavy nasal discharge usually mean it's a migraine. True sinus headaches are rare. In a study of nearly 3,000 patients, 88% of people who thought they'd had them were suffering from migraines. Andrew Hershey, MD, PhD, Director of Neurology at the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, says, quote, "People assume migraines are completely debilitating, but more often than not, patients rate their severity as moderate," end of quote. Hershey's advice, if over-the-counter pain meds don't help in an hour, or if you're having more than 2 headaches per week, talk to your doctor or a headache specialist. And the second of 3 questions, frequent tension, headaches, lay off blank, and do more blank. Answer A, lay off partying and do more hydrating. Answer B, lay off texting and do more rowing. Answer C, lay off driving and do more walking. Answer D, lay off blowouts and do more acupuncture. The answer is B, lay off texting and do more rowing. Hunching forward over your phone may be a surprising source of tension headaches, but the position overtaxes muscles in your neck and shoulders, says Stacy Pierce Talsma, D.O., chair of the Osteopathic Manipulative Medicine Department at Touro University, California. She says, quote, angling your head over your phone can put up to 60 pounds of pressure on your spine, compared with 10 to 12 pounds when your head is upright. Doing that day after day can create serious problems, end of quote. Try putting down your phone to get on a rowing machine or take a Pilates class, which can strengthen both your shoulders and upper back. And our third question, which is a better strategy to safeguard your brain from pain? A, take a day each week to completely decompress. B, start each morning with a few sun salutations. The answer, B. Incorporating moments of relaxation into your daily routine can help keep head pain at bay. One study found that migraine sufferers who added yoga 5 times a week to their conventional treatment had fewer episodes and less intense symptoms than those who didn't. At the bare minimum, Pierce Talsma encourages patients to set an alarm to go off every hour, then spend at least a minute stretching and taking deep breaths. Our fourth and final question. Which sleep schedules are most likely to hurt your head? A, 7 hours during the week, 10 on the weekend. B, 5 or 6 hours a night as long as you feel rested. C, 7 to 8 hours no matter the day of the week. D, 9.5 hours every night. So which of these sleep schedules are most likely to hurt your head? All of them except for C, which was 7 or 8 hours. People who get migraines and average only 6 hours a night have more frequent and more severe headaches than those who sleep more, according to a study in the journal Headache. But too much sleep can also kickstart a headache, though experts aren't entirely sure why. And if you sleep late on the weekend and delay your normal morning dose of coffee, you might prompt a caffeine withdrawal headache. Try for a midday nap instead. Aim for a solid 7 to 8 hours of sleep every night. You'll be more likely to rise and shine. And February is National Heart Month. So in February 2018, we had this article from the Feeling Good section, Time for a Heart to Heart. In honor of American Heart Month, Tara Narula, MD, has an important message for women, especially women of color. When I started seeing patient K last year, she was at the top of her game. At 54, she was a newlywed and a powerhouse at work who exercised and ate healthily. Yet she'd recently had a sudden onset of chest pain at the office. After undergoing a battery of tests at the hospital, she was diagnosed with high blood pressure. K was shocked. How could she have felt so good and still be facing such a danger? Cardiovascular disease, CVD, is the umbrella term for disorders of the heart and blood vessels, including coronary heart disease, heart attack, problems with the structure of the heart, abnormal heart rhythms, and stroke. It is the leading killer of American women, taking more lives each year than all cancers combined. CVD could happen to you or to a woman you love. And while it affects women of every background, those of color, like Kay, are especially vulnerable, yet also particularly unaware of their risks. Nearly half of black women and around one-third of Mexican-American women have CVD, according to the American Heart Association. One of the biggest issues is risk factors. 46% of black women and 31% of Hispanic women have high blood pressure, compared with 32% of whites, 82% of black women, and 77% of Hispanic women are overweight or obese, compared with 63% of whites. Nearly 14% of black women and 13% of Hispanic women have diabetes, compared with about 7% of whites. Physical inactivity is also a greater problem among black and Hispanic women. People's beliefs about health can be framed by their background, but we experts haven't done the best job of helping patients understand their risk. While 65% of white women know that CVD is their most significant health threat, only 36% of black women and 34% of Hispanic women do. We're trying to change that. For my part, I've been asking all my patients, but especially black and Hispanic women, about their family history, diet, stress, and smoking, alcohol, and exercise habits. I inform them of the importance of keeping track of their blood pressure, cholesterol, blood sugar, and body mass index. I also inquire about their pregnancies, gestational hypertension, gestational diabetes, and preeclampsia are associated with increased future risk of CVD. I use their answers to inform them of their risk level. We also talk about heart attack symptoms, which can include chest pain, shortness of breath, neck or jaw pain, and fatigue. Most important, I make clear that 80% of CVD cases may be prevented by keeping your numbers in their ideal range, quitting smoking, maintaining a healthy weight, and exercising. I also emphasize the importance of being proactive and prioritizing health. Kay is doing just that, taking blood pressure medication, continuing to exercise and eat well, and watching her numbers. Her heart is doing great. Prevention includes scheduling a Well Woman annual exam to discuss health issues before they become serious and to create a care plan just for you. There's no bigger show of love this month, that is February, than to honor and protect your heart and be an example to the women you hold dear. And on a sidebar, under the heading Blazing Trails, two community groups working to strengthen women's hearts. And they are Girl Trek and Black Girls Run. So let's hear about Girl Trek. In 2012, after noticing many of their loved ones were in physical and emotional crisis, friends T. Morgan Dixon and Vanessa Garrison started the nonprofit Girl Trek, quote, a national walking community, end of quote, now nearly 117,000 members strong, designed to help black women and girls get healthier together. Research has shown a lack of social support may be a major barrier to exercise for black women. Garrison says, quote, walking helps reduce the risk of heart disease and also improves mental health. Plus, our events give women a chance to discuss and solve problems. End of quote. Just do it. Sign up at girltrek.com to find or host walks near you. Routes range from 1 mile strolls to brisk 5Ks, and everyone is encouraged to walk at her own pace. And the last one is Black Girls Run. Toni Carey discovered the healing power of running when it helped her get through a tough breakup. In 2009, she co-founded Black Girls Run with pal Ashley Hicks Roca as a way to encourage African American women to prioritize healthy habits. But you don't have to love running to join. Carey says, quote, I was intimidated at first, too. That's why we provide supportive group leaders and start slow, end of quote. Black Girls Run now counts 160,000 plus women as members. Just do it. Go to blackgirlsrun.com to join one of about 70 running groups nationwide. They're led by volunteer ambassadors who schedule runs and communicate with members via social media. From the March 2018 issue, we have from Feeling Good, in one ear, out the other. If your memory is slipping, it may be time to dial back your phone use. I've recently noticed myself blanking on things I never thought I'd forget, like my own zip code, says Laurel Liked. Maybe I just have a lot on my mind, or maybe the iPhone glued to my hand is part of the problem. A 2016 study in the journal Memory showed that relying on tech makes our brains lazy. Researchers found that when people were allowed to Google answers to difficult questions, they became more likely to turn to the search engine to help answer simple ones as well. Smartphones also hamper our ability to recall things by overwhelming our mind with distractions, says Susan Lehman, MD, clinical director of geriatric psychiatry and neuropsychiatry at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. She says, quote, "When you use these devices, you're often switching quickly between topics or conversations. That rapid change in focus can prevent an idea or thought from sufficiently registering in your memory," end of quote. Want to bolster your powers of recall? Try these savvy tips. And we have six tips here. The first one, hide your device. A mere glimpse, even if the screen is dark, slashes your capacity to pay attention and remember, according to a new study from the University of Texas. Study co-author Adrian Ward, PhD, says, quote, "The process of resisting the temptation to use it can reduce your ability to think clearly," end of quote. When you're not making calls or sending texts, stash your phone in a desk drawer or in another room of your home. Here's the second savvy tip. Go offline. Turn on Do Not Disturb mode. In settings, you can then allow calls only from selected contacts. This way, you'll get important or expected notifications, but avoid the non-urgent ones. Look what Alice just tweeted. That clamor for your attention. You can also consider swapping your usual device for a credit card size light phone, $150 at thelightphone.com. It syncs with your smartphone so you can make and receive calls, but that's it. No other temptations or distractions. The third savvy tip, hang out with Facebook friends. People over 40 who reported socializing with friends and family in the past week were likelier than those who were more isolated to rate their memory as excellent or very good, a 2017 AARP Brain Health Survey found. Cynthia Green, PhD and assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City, says, quote, "This is a real benefit to talking face to face. If you connect by text or email, it's not the same test of intellectual or social skills," end of quote. And here's our fourth savvy tip. Pick up a pen. Scribble down quotes, important dates, and other details you want to keep in your mind. Writing notes on paper led to better memory retention than typing on laptops in a 2014 study published in Psychological Science. Typing is often mindless transcribing, but handwriting requires more time and focus, says Ward. The process helps encode information into your memory. You can still use a notes app for minutiae like grocery lists or promo codes for online shopping. And the fifth tip, ban your device from meetings. When you're interacting with people or completing a task, your brain relies on what's called working memory, short-term recall for details that are important in the moment, like sales figures, but might not be in a few weeks. Lehman says, quote, "Working memory enables us to hold on to new information so we can decide whether to convert it to long-term storage," end of quote. If you're distracted by your phone while an idea is in working memory, you might not be able to access it later. And our sixth and final savvy tip, put your phone to bed. Lehman says, quote, "Memory is consolidated during sleep," end of quote. She advises turning off all devices at least an hour before bed and charging them on the other side of the bedroom, not your nightstand, so you won't be tempted to sneak peeks when you should be getting Z's. Also, from March 2018, we have this article, Living with Lung Cancer. The disease that used to be a death sentence isn't necessarily so anymore. Some women are managing it and even thriving. When Linnea Olson was told in June 2008 that the cancer she'd been battling for 3 years had spread from one lung to the other, she began preparing to die. Given just 3 to 5 months to live, the then 48-year-old artist and lifelong non-smoker embarked on a farewell tour, saying goodbye to family and friends and arranging grief counseling for her youngest son, then 11. She wasn't sure she'd live long enough to make it to her daughter's wedding later that summer. When she did, she spent the day looking at her three children and thinking about how their lives would be after she was gone. Then an oncologist tested Olson's cancerous tissue for a specific genetic mutation whose presence enabled Olson to enroll in a clinical trial for a drug called crizotinib, brand name Zalcori. What happened next seemed nothing short of miraculous. Olson says, quote, "Within days, my constant coughing and shortness of breath were gone," end of quote. 7 weeks later, every single one of the 33 tumors in her lungs had almost completely disappeared. As recently as 20 years ago, a turnaround like this would have been unheard of. And indeed, according to the American Cancer Society, lung cancer still kills more women than breast, ovarian, and uterine cancers combined, with a 5-year survival rate of only 21%. Yet despite the disease's ferocious nature, the medical community's understanding of it has recently evolved, with the result that some patients are outliving dire prognoses and many more are filled with hope. Olson, like up to 15% of Americans diagnosed with lung cancer, is a never smoker. Medical speak for those who have smoked fewer than 100 cigarettes in their lifetime. Though exposure to air pollution, radon, and secondhand smoke are risk factors, science doesn't yet know all the reasons why such patients are being diagnosed in increasing numbers, says Andrea McKee, MD, chairman of radiation oncology for Lahey Hospital and Medical Center in Massachusetts, and a scientific advisor for the American Lung Association. Still, oncologists are learning more every day. McKee says, quote, "We're discovering how lung cancer behaves, how the cells differ between non-smokers and smokers, and how we can use various genetic mutations to shape treatment," end of quote. One game-changing finding is what led to Olson's reprieve. About 50 to 60% of never-smoking patients have one of many targetable mutations in their lung cancer cells that cause the cells to multiply and divide more quickly and aggressively, explains Olson's oncologist Alice Shaw, MD, PhD, director of thoracic oncology at Massachusetts General Hospital. By comparison, about 20% of all lung cancer patients, regardless of smoking history, are thought to have such driver mutations. Women seem to be slightly more prone to them than men. Over the past 5 years, Shaw says, it's become standard practice for patients diagnosed with advanced lung cancer to have their tumors tested for these mutations, called oncogenes, which cause cancer when activated. Why does that matter? Shaw says, quote, "Now that we have a better understanding of what is driving these cancers' growth, it opens up a whole new array of treatment options," end of quote. Among them, targeted therapies, including tyrosine kinase inhibitors, TKIs, the first of which were approved by the Food and Drug Administration for treating some lung cancers in 2003. TKIs have kept Olson thriving for years past her original prognosis. Easier to tolerate than traditional chemotherapy, which notoriously attacks every healthy cell in a patient's body in an effort to kill the cancerous ones. TKIs are oral medications that home in on cancer cells specifically, turning off oncogene mutations. Because of this selective assault, fewer healthy cells are affected, and side effects can be milder than with chemotherapy. Although TKIs can still cause nausea, diarrhea, memory problems, and fatigue, which Olson has experienced. Patients take a pill once or twice daily and undergo tests every few months to monitor progress. In clinical trials, up to 90% of patients with certain mutations experience some degree of tumor shrinkage or stabilization, extending life expectancy. The catch is that in all likelihood, the cancer will eventually become resistant to the drug, typically after a year or two, which means patients will need to try a different treatment. Olson is on her third TKI. Targeted therapies aren't the only new life-extending option. When lung cancer patients are screened for oncogene mutations, they're also tested for something called PD-L1 expression. Here, doctors are looking for a critical mass of tumor cells that produce a high amount of a particular protein marker. Patricia L. Rich, MD, Medical Oncology Director of Cancer Treatment Centers of America's Lung Cancer Institute, says, quote, "If the PD-L1 results are high enough and the other actionable mutations are not present, then you try immunotherapy," end of quote. That's what happened in Nancy Vandespoel's case. Vandespoel, a 47-year-old New Yorker, beat stage 3 lung cancer in 2012 via chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. Then in 2016, the never smoker was horrified to learn her cancer had returned. Her doctors tested her growing tumor, hoping it might respond to drugs that harness the immune system to fight cancer. Rich explains, quote, "Cancer cells are smart enough to release chemical signals that tell the immune system to stop fighting them. But immunotherapy treatments can turn off those signals or help the body generate supercharged cancer-killing immune cells," end of quote. Currently approved for advanced lung cancers as well as melanoma and cancers of the head and neck, kidneys, and a few others, immunotherapy typically involves an IV infusion every 2 to 3 weeks. Never smokers have seen benefits. So far, the results are impressive. A New England Journal of Medicine study found that for patients who'd already had a round of chemotherapy, the overall survival rate at 1 year was 42% for those on the immunotherapy drug nivolumab, Opdivo is the brand name, versus 24% for just a second round of chemo. Combining the two is even more promising. Patients using the immunotherapy drug pembrolizumab, Keytruda is the brand name, plus chemo had an overall response rate of 55%, compared with 29% for chemo alone. However, as with targeted therapy, patients are likely to develop a resistance that will necessitate switching to another drug. Immunotherapy seemed to stop Vandespoel's tumor in its tracks. It didn't grow or spread in the years since her last treatment in January 2017. She doesn't talk about her prognosis with her physicians. She's focusing on enjoying every breath she takes. The side effects of immunotherapy, fatigue, nausea, and ever-present full-body pain, have had an impact on Vandespoel's day-to-day life. She says, quote, "But at least I have a rest of my life. I used to be able to chase my grandson around the park. Now I sit and watch him play. And I'm so happy to be able to do that and to be able to kiss my family and just be alive," end of quote. She credits family and friends locally and in Puerto Rico, where she's originally from, for helping keep her spirits up. Olson, for her part, cheekily calls herself terminally optimistic. She's living in an artist's community in Lowell, Massachusetts, and spends her time painting, doing street photography, and working on a blog called Life and Breath, Outliving Lung Cancer. She says, quote, "I may not be a survivor, but for now, I am surviving." Moving to the April issue of Oprah, from the Feeling Good section, we have an article called Scratch That. On second thought, don't. There are more effective ways to deal with an inch. It demands relief, yet it doesn't hurt. Making it feel better may actually make it worse, and its reason for being is often a total mystery. No wonder itching, or as science calls it, pruritus, still has medical experts scratching their heads. Around 1 in 10 people suffers from chronic itchiness. For them and the rest of us, the best defense against the torture depends on its cause, and there are many. And we'll deal with five of them here, the first of which is a neurological issue. When nerves become damaged or compressed through injury or aging, they can respond by sending the brain an incessant scratch me message, says Ariane Kourouche, MD, assistant professor of dermatology at Harvard Medical School. This can affect any body part, but most commonly occurs on the arms, middle of the back, or scalp. Here's the fix. Anti-epileptic drugs and antidepressants have been found to reduce itchiness, as has Botox, which can interfere with the nerve's ability to relay the scratch signal. Physical therapy, Tai Chi, yoga, and acupuncture may also help, theoretically by decompressing or reducing the activity of the affected nerve, says Serena Almaria, MD, PhD, a dermatologist at Massachusetts General Hospital, who studies pruritus. And the next cause, inflammation. During bouts of internal inflammation brought on by allergies, autoimmune glitches, or a reaction to medication, like statins, opiates, or even herbal supplements, the body releases defensive molecules that set off varied responses, including itchiness. The fix. Cortisone creams or oral antihistamines can extinguish the flame of the itch. Drugstore moisturizers and protectant skin creams can prevent it from reigniting. If your meds are to blame, a new prescription may be all you need. And here's one more reason, anxiety. Intense stress can influence nerve function, which can lead to pain or a relentless itch, Almaria says. Stressed out scratchers have been known to scrape their skin raw. The fix, treatment for this type of itch addresses both the mind and the body and can include biofeedback, meditation, or acupuncture, as well as cognitive behavioral therapy and medication. And our next to the last reason for itching, disease. A range of unrelated conditions that affect the kidney, liver, thyroid, and blood all may trigger obsessive scratching. So can autoimmune disorders, diabetes, and skin cancer. The fix. If you have one of these issues as well as an itch, see a dermatologist who may prescribe ointments or oral treatments. Almaria also suggests yoga, meditation, or Tai Chi to reduce stress. And our final cause of itching, insect bites. When a mosquito gets you, your immune system releases chemicals, including histamine, that prompt redness, swelling, and itching. The fix? If your bite stays puffy and inflamed for a prolonged period, you're likely having a heightened allergic reaction. A cortisone cream or an over-the-counter antihistamine should help, says Kourouche. Constant scratching may delay healing, so try holding an ice pack on your bite. Cold temps make it harder for the itch-triggering nerve to communicate with your brain. Heat has the opposite effect. Plus, your scratch-happy fingers will stay safely occupied. And still in the April issue, how not to get hooked on pain pills. Prescription opioids have damaged and even destroyed millions of lives. Don't let them claim yours. Christina Cruz Miller, 39, trusted her family doctor's judgment when he wrote her prescriptions for oxycodone in 2002 after her surgery for endometriosis. And why wouldn't she? At that time, the pills were considered a godsend for patients with all kinds of pain. Cruz Miller says, quote, "I thought I was healing," end of quote. After 3 days, though, quote, "the beast within me was awakened. I started taking my meds more frequently to avoid any potential pain. By day 10, I was hooked," end of quote. Over the next 6 years, Cruz Miller spiraled downward, dipping into heroin use and ultimately landing in a pool of vomit on the floor of a jail cell. She spent 6 months recovering in a Florida Department of Corrections program run by the Salvation Army. Now sober for 9 years, she is a married working mother of three daughters. In hindsight, she says, quote, "I would rather deal with my post-surgical pain all day, every day, end of quote, than go through the horrific ordeal of opioid addiction. Cruz Miller's story isn't as unusual as you might think. Many of those who overdose on opioids are people just like her. Their moms, grandpas, or high school students whose journey into hell involved a prescription from a doctor. Currently, more than 214 million prescriptions for opioids are written each year in the U.S. It's an inconvenient truth for physicians and health experts as they scramble to contain an epidemic that sends more than 1,000 people to emergency rooms every day and more than 16,000 to their grave each year. Prescription opioids block pain and flood us with feel-good chemicals, making them just as addictive as their illicit cousin, heroin. The situation has become so dire that even the CDC has come out against them for some pain. Yet opioids remain a ready way to deal with physical suffering. Despite warnings, many doctors still overprescribe them. Here's what you need to know to minimize your misery and avoid a slide into misuse and addiction. If you have significant yet likely temporary pain, for example, after surgery, an injury like a broken wrist, or a medical issue like a kidney stone, reevaluate what's bearable. Many Americans expect that doctors and drugs should be able to eradicate discomfort. Bradley C. Martin, Ph.D., professor of pharmacy practice and founding head of the Pharmaceutical Evaluation and Policy Division at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences in Little Rock, says, quote, "That's inconsistent with attitudes elsewhere in the world, where patients and physicians recognize that a certain amount of pain is to be expected after trauma or surgery," end of quote. This distaste for discomfort can be traced to the 1990s, when some experts became concerned that doctors weren't fully addressing the effect of pain on patients' well-being. Opioids, previously meted out to terminal cancer patients or following major surgery, became a key part of the new anti-pain strategy. Instead of being given in small amounts as a last resort, they were more likely to be prescribed generously and proactively for procedures as mundane as tooth extraction. While the pendulum is finally swinging back the other way, it's still true that, quote, "if you demand that your pain disappear immediately, you're likely to come away with drugs," end of quote, says Beth Darnell, Ph.D., clinical professor at Stanford University School of Medicine and author of The Opioid-Free Pain Relief Kit. That could be more harmful than helpful. Using opioids to get rid of all the hurt not only poses the risk of dependence, but it also interferes with the body's immune response and slows the healing process, says Anna Lemke, MD, medical director for addiction medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine and author of Drug Dealer, MD. Consider over-the-counter relief first. Don't underestimate the power of ibuprofen and acetaminophen, unless you have certain pre-existing conditions. Check with your doc. Taken together, these drugstore analgesics can provide relief comparable to opioids for pain due to broken bones and oral surgeries, studies say. Explore all the options. Ask your doctor about non-pharmaceutical ways, for instance, ice or heat, to find relief from acute pain. Chris Johnson, MD, chair of the Minnesota Department of Human Services Opioid Prescribing Work Group, says, quote, "think about taking an opioid only after you've tried everything else," end of quote. Take less than what's prescribed. Unlike antibiotics, which you take in prescribed doses to kill bacteria, opioids are optional. And remember, quote, "after just a few days, many people can become physiologically dependent," end of quote, Martin says. While some may not notice any withdrawal symptoms when they stop their medication, others, perhaps due to their biological makeup, may shake with anxiety, feel achy all over, and become hypersensitive to pain. Martin says, quote, "some people call it the opioid flu," end of quote. Martin, who adds that it can drive patients back to the pills, then back to their doctor or another source for a refill. Addiction, defined as compulsive use despite harmful repercussions, isn't inevitable, but while people with a history of depression, anxiety, or alcohol, tobacco, or drug abuse are at particular risk, it can happen to anyone. If you have chronic pain, for example, backache, fibromyalgia, arthritis, migraines, know the risks of taking these pills. Until the 1990s, treating chronic pain conditions with opioids was practically unheard of because using them long-term seemed to guarantee addiction issues. But while doctors focused on fully treating pain, a massive campaign underwritten by drug makers promised that, while patients would likely develop a physiological dependence on the drugs over time, the risk of addiction was relatively low. Andrew Kolodny, MD, Executive Director of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing, says, quote, "They made it seem like opioid dependence was no big deal. Patients could stay on the drugs to ease their chronic pain, and if they eventually wanted to stop, they just need to taper off slowly." End of quote. That's not how it worked. Chronic pain patients not only developed a tolerance to opioids over time, but many also became addicted with sometimes deadly consequences. See a healthcare provider who treats your whole body, not just the part that hurts. Make sure your doctor stays involved in your care, even if he or she refers you to another expert. Be picky about specialists. An array of providers can subspecialize in pain medicine. Jim Lenser, MD, president of the American Board of Pain Medicine, says, quote, "Anesthesiologists sometimes do nothing but injections. A physiatrist may focus on rehabilitation. A family practitioner might rely on medication." End of quote. Your goal, a pain specialist whose expertise meets your needs and preferences. For example, if you'd rather try PT than take pills, and who is certified by the American Board of Pain Medicine or the board of their specialty. Become the boss of your pain. Learn what you can about your issue, including best practices for treatment. For example, opioids are not generally recommended for migraine headaches, fibromyalgia, and lower back pain. Use the right lingo when talking to experts. Ask about your options for comprehensive pain management. This shows that you're serious about becoming more independent of doctors and clinicians and pills over time, and charges them with empowering you to do so. And we've run out of this special episode of Oprah Magazine, which has covered health topics going all the way back to last fall and the spring of this year. Be sure to listen next time when we pick up with our September issue. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after our broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.